Welcome to my first episode of Undefined By, a podcast that uncovers the stories behind successful people to discover what makes them so much more than what they're known for or associated with, what they're undefined by, and how that's played a part in their journey to happiness and success. This is my first guest episode, and it's actually the first one I recorded. I knew as soon as I had the concept for this podcast that I wanted to have Nasima on. We come from the old school beauty blogging days and have been following each other for years. Nasima is a fiercely independent and unapologetically proud Moroccan Muslim woman. We talk about how her career started in fashion before falling in love with teaching and interning at some iconic British magazines, and then pivoting her career due to work-related stress and burnout. Nasima shares what she loves about the beauty industry and how there needs to be more inclusivity and awareness for Muslim women in the community and brand campaigns. We dive into what life is like as mothers and content creators with ADHD and so much more. Here is Nasima Egouche, undefined by being a Muslim woman. Enjoy. So obviously this came out of the blue for you of messaging you about the podcast. You were one of the first people that I wanted to have on because of your background and the switch and what you do and what you represent and all that kind of stuff. I would love to know, how would you introduce or describe yourself and who you are?
Well, a woman that loves change, apparently. So, well, my name is Nasima. I'm 33 years old. I was born in Morocco, but have lived in the UK, specifically in West London, since I was a baby. Moved here with my family. It was my dad's job that brought us here, actually. And we haven't moved back. And fast forward to now, I have been a teacher. Kind of life took me down that direction, even though when I was finishing up uni, I wanted to work in fashion. I got a job in Harrods and that kind of, I jumped from brand to brand and I thought fashion was going to be it for me. And then I got invited to New York Bridal Fashion Week with a brand that I worked with. And everyone was so mean. Everyone was so like, it was literally what you see in the films. And actually, I still stand by that today. Fashion and beauty are two completely different industries. And the people, even when I work with fashion brands today or like, fashion people in the fashion industry, I'm like, you kind of mean, but I feel like that's just the industry. And so to think back then when I was actually the slimmest I've ever been, I felt so big in like this sea of like skinny models, and this was like 2010, so skinny was still very much in. I came back from that trip and I was like, no, fashion's not happening for me. Like, as much as I love it, I like being nice and I also like people being nice to me. So in that same year, I took a trip to Uganda with my old sixth form. Was like a trip that they used to do, and ended up in Uganda, first time anywhere else in Africa other than Morocco. And I absolutely loved it. And I had the opportunity to teach children there. And I guess I came back to London and I thought, I want to be a teacher. Then my first day in a classroom in London was not the same as Africa.
No.
But I guess luckily, because I'm literally, I mean, I can't really say born and bred, but I would, you know, as close to born and bred London as you can be, I was like, oh, I can handle that. That's absolutely fine. Started off with primary school and very quickly decided that was not for me. I think I was like, I needed like the sarcasm. I needed older kids that I could kind of vibe with. I think the little ones were so sweet and delicate, but also like, that's not me. So I eventually became a French and Spanish teacher. And I did that for about 10 years. And what changed was basically when I had a baby 7 years in and I went on maternity leave, and that was my first break from that, where I was like, oh yeah, I'm done. I think I'm done. Like, I want to do something else. And on the side of that, actually, when I first started my proper teaching job, coincidentally, I started to develop adult acne for the first time. I had never even had teenage acne. I think I used to just get like one spot around my period, which I used to pick and scar and destroy. But it was just the one.
Do you think you did from the job?
The breakout? Absolutely, 100%. Because it was the acne, and it was all hormonal, so it was all around my chin.
Yeah.
And it was the grays. I went in with like salt and pepper grays and I came out with 90%
wow
coverage. Yeah, I gave those children my 20s and my good hair. I came out like heavier, gray strength. I love that job. I love being with the kids, but becoming a mom and being a teacher, that it was the clash for me because it was just like, I can't do both things well. And my mat leave ended, I think, the day that lockdown started. So I was very lucky because I basically got more time at home with her, but it didn't work. When I went back part-time and all of those things. And on the side, I had this little side project, which was Instagram, which was basically, I mean, if you know, you were around from back then, it was like 2013, 2014, which was just sharing. And it was, I used to share all beauty things on my private Instagram. And I used to have like some of my male friends like, oh, why are you talking about that? And I was like, okay, well, you've got a point there. Let me start a new page. Because maybe you guys are not the ones. Maybe let me start a new page and just find that community. And that's basically where Beautyma was born. It was like Beauty, Nasima. It's a pretty simple mix. And I would share my acne journey and meet other people. And do you know what? And I mean, I'm sure you agree with this. Back then, it was so nice because it, you know, the brands hadn't gotten involved with that community just yet. The community that we had, and we sent each other things, and it was just such a nice, like the whole skinfluencer thing started so organically, and then it blew up.
I remember I raced down to Brown Thomas, which is the equivalent of like Selfridges or Harrods in Ireland, for one of Charlotte Tilbury's new products. And I raced down that morning, got it applied, learned all the info from the MUAs, came home, shot a little like mini campaign, I suppose is what it would be called now. But back then it was just like, I got this really cool foundation. Oh, and by the way, I've got a like vase of roses. So like, let's put those together and take a picture. And Charlotte Tilbury or her team picked it up and wanted to use it in the campaign for the product. And I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. I'm pretty sure I should be doing something about like, how do you negotiate this? I contacted every talent agency in the UK and Ireland, and nobody knew what to do. They all said like, oh my God, and she's like wanting to use the image. I'm like, yeah, what do I do? And they're like, oh my God, well, I mean, we've never heard of anything like this before. So, I mean, obviously you're going to let her, aren't you? And I was like, well, yeah, but do I not, like, is there not some kind of exchange? You know, is there nothing? And again, I did do work experience for several Paris Fashion Weeks in an agency. So I knew roughly kind of how this thing should go, but because it was such a new,
yeah,
you know, it really was like carving out a career. Like the career didn't exist before that. And so nothing ever happened. My image was all across the front page. It was in her website. It was all in her email campaigns. And I was just like, oh, well, and I guess that's my image there. I also have a question about teaching. When you are a teacher and you have your own children, is it, and I know that you experienced it, and I know so many other teachers experienced it, like the burnout. Is it that you're constantly pouring into children, both at home and at work? Is that what leads to it, or is it something else?
You know, pretty interesting is you don't know you're burning out. You're constantly pouring more and more of yourself where there's nothing to give. And I guess, yeah, then I realized as a mother going home, like, I'm too tired to be my own child's mother. And then, you know, you kind of think, you're like, okay, so then it becomes a vicious cycle because someone else would look after my child. But I'm pretty sure that someone else, you know, it was a year where all the nurseries were doing their strikes. So I'm pretty sure all they're suffering as well. So it's like, so are we all just going to just be hanging on by a dear thread, looking after each other's kids? So I thought, well, this is where I need to kind of cut that. And I'd rather burn out looking after my own kids happily and create those memories than have to do that.
Yeah, I went through burnout as well. I've been through it a few times. I had it really, really bad in 2021 and 2022. I've only just started to recover now at the end of 2023. And again, like you say, you don't know that it's happening. I didn't know it was happening until I was speaking to a business and life coach, and I was coming on to the call and I was in all kinds of mess. I was like, what's wrong? And why do I feel like that? And she was like, babe, you're burnt out. And to have someone tell you that that's what the problem is and that's why you're feeling that way was like a huge weight got lifted off of me. But yeah, I missed all of the signs and the cues until it was way too late. And then my body started suffering the consequences. So you changed then careers, kind of. So what do you do now and why do you do it?
So leaving teaching was a very, very difficult decision because it was everything that I knew and I was really good at it and I really enjoyed it. It was, you know, in theory, easy because it was like, oh, no, you know, I've done this for so I can do this with my eyes closed. But the fun and the joy and the love was gone. So it was very much checked out. So I was signed sort of obviously on alongside my teaching career. I always had this kind of side thing with Instagram and never monetized it and never had enough followers, to be fair, to even think about that. But, you know, fast forward to 2019, 2020, brands were picking up and that's kind of, you know, blogs and YouTube were already well established by then. I tried YouTube in 2014. I tried blogging, but like I now realize having undiagnosed ADHD at the time, that's why I couldn't stick to anything. I didn't know it at the time, but I got picked up by a talent agency and they represented Muslim women, which I thought was so cool, so niche. So I was introduced to them and I had a conversation with them about it. Now, just to go back for a second, during my maternity leave, when I had decided that I wanted to leave teaching, I had the opportunity to intern at Cosmopolitan UK with their beauty team.
I remember this. It was amazing. I was cheering you on. So, such an incredible opportunity.
Do you know what's funny? I got it. And the day before I almost cancelled it because Layla was 5.5 months old and I was still breastfeeding. And I was like,
yeah,
wow, how am I going to do this? And also I was very precious about my mat leave because I was very conscious that it was ending in 6 months and 5 months, whatever. So I was like, you know, no. And it's a 9 to 6 and I have to go all the way to central London. And basically, yeah, I had this kind of, I guess, some doubts and some, what's that thing that we all have when imposter syndrome? I was like, yeah, I don't belong there. I'm sure, like, you know, I've seen Ugly Betty. And I'm too old. And that's another thing. It was just like, I'm too old. And I was 29. So I was like, I'm going to be the oldest person there.
If there's a 2 in your age, you're not too old for anything.
The problem with 29 is it goes 29 turning 30. And it's suddenly you just stop saying you're 29 and you're just saying I'm turning 30. So I almost didn't go, but I did because when I was 16, I always used to want to be, I mean, I watched The Hills and then suddenly I wanted to be Lauren Conrad and blah, blah, blah. So I was like, oh my God, my teenage dream. So I don't know if it's my Moroccan-ness, my Leo-ness, I don't know what it is, but I don't quit unless I really have to. So I was like, no, it's more embarrassing to have to send that email to say I can't come and sorry and I'm a flop. Let me just go. And I went and from day one, I absolutely loved it. So it was a month-long internship. Now, I went in with no plan. I kind of just went in to enjoy it, like to just experience it. And when I think back on it, I wish I went in with pitches. I wish I went in kind of with a plan of what to do next. I didn't. But what I did come out with is then knowing what I wanted to do next. So I was like, okay, I want to be a beauty writer and I can do this kind of now from home.
How was it different or similar to the fashion and beauty industry, the magazine industry?
Well, I did beauty for both. So if I think back to fashion from a decade before, beauty is more inclusive and more accepting. That's what I loved. It was refreshing to see beauty journalists that were plus size, that were women of color, and I love that it was also a woman-led industry, a little bit more than fashion, I think. What I didn't love is, and I think this kind of is very prevalent in the journalism industry at the moment, is very dated and very traditional and kind of, we don't need to change things. Everything's fine. And I'm like, well, let's get with the times and things changing and TikTok and social media, let's intertwine. No. Print. And I'm like, yeah, that's not my vibe. I like to have something where you're in control of what you say, what you do, what you write, what you say, what you record.
But isn't it great that like sometimes knowing what you don't want is as equally helpful in finding out what you do? So it was at that point that the Muslim talent agency picked you up?
It was at that point.
So how did you go from being picked up? First of all, I love that there is a Muslim talent agency. This is a very surreal experience for me hearing you talk about this when I've been the other side of that little Instagram app watching this happen and now hearing your side of it. It's actually really nice. But I love that there was a Muslim talent agency and that was one of the reasons why I was like, I want to talk to you about that. And also, how do you go from being picked up from a talent agency to then working at the talent? Like, how did you manage, or how did that switch come about?
So in terms of the talent agency itself, the founder, who is a very good friend of mine, she basically saw a massive gap in the industry where we were starting to see, and as a consumer, I saw this myself, we were starting to see Muslim women be included in the ads and campaigns, but it was always tokenism. It was always one. Like, there's only space for one. It might be a black girl, might be an Asian girl, but there will only be one.
Yeah.
And then we noticed that only one demographic was ever being represented, which, to be fair, statistically in the UK, you know, British Muslims are predominantly South Asian. And that's absolutely fine. But there's so many of us that are not. There are so many of us that don't wear a hijab, myself included. There's a huge community of black Muslim women that are almost invisible in press, media, and advertising.
Because they're like, you're a Muslim and you're black. For sure, there's no room for you on this campaign.
Well, it's triple because then you're a woman. That also.
Oh, of course. So I just take that for a given.
There we go. So it's like three things. And so the founder of the agency is from the black community. She's Muslim, but I wear a hijab and she is a woman. So it's kind of like, okay, so where are we? Because, you know, even when it comes to maybe things with Black History Month and those kind of things, well, Muslim women don't fit into that. Okay, in the Muslim women community, the black women are not being represented. And so it became the agency that was, it wasn't just to represent black women, it was to represent all Muslim women. And it's such a lovely, diverse group. And what she did, it was so nice having someone that understood that in Ramadan, things are different, and understood that, no, we can't promote alcohol. Do I have to explain that to you? And we can't, you know, and it's, you'd be surprised, and it's 2024 and we are still seeing things like getting invites to, you know, bars and clubs for the girls that they can't go there. It has changed. It's, if you, you know, look at Charlotte Tilbury and on her sort of, on her website and all the swatches, you see Muslim women visibly there. And it just makes it, it's so nice to feel like you're just, because I, you know, I'm not sure about where you live, but definitely walking around London, it's very visible. It's such a multicultural community. But then when you go online or where you go in the press, you're like, oh, it's not reflected there. So how comes I can see it in front of me? Otherwise, I wouldn't live here.
So then you became one of the agents yourself there, right?
I did. Yeah. Yeah. So I was signed as talent, but obviously 2020 became a bit slow because a lot of things happened. And I was, 2021 is when I decided to want to leave teaching, when that's when I had no idea what to do next. And so I was like, I'm not here. I'm not making any money yet on social media, and definitely not enough to catch up to like my teaching salary. So I don't know what to do. And I just had this very honest conversation with my manager. She's like, well, I'm looking for a talent manager. I was like, well, what's that? I don't know anything about that. She was like, well, you're the talent and you're a teacher, and with teaching, you can manage. And so literally it was almost like just the perfect kind of, it was the perfect transition out of teaching. And I did that part-time. So I did that one day a week whilst I was part-time teaching, just to kind of phase myself out. Because whilst I can be very impulsive, I also, I guess because I'm a mother now, I can't be. So I'm like, yeah, let me just give it the year. And I had a year 11 class and I didn't want to leave them. And I thought, let me give it the year and let me leave, give like kind of a year's notice in my head. So I left in summer 2022. And that September is when I started as talent manager, kind of almost full time. But I loved it. It was working from home. It was flexible. And I will never like forget that, because for Layla's first little nursery experience, I was there every day. And I'm so grateful for that. So I did it for 2 years.
Did you know that LED light therapy has been clinically proven to reduce redness and inflammation, boost blood circulation, and accelerate collagen production? It also improves skin firmness, evens out skin tone, and reduces the signs of aging. Since I started using the Current Body LED mask a few years ago, it has dramatically improved my skin tone, texture, and firmness, and reduced my redness, acne scarring, and pigmentation. I don't get as many hormonal breakouts as I used to, and when I do, they fade much faster.
My skin feels smoother and firmer, and it looks more youthful, clear, and radiant. The Current Body LED Mask is 31% more powerful than others, featuring 132 LED red and near-infrared bulbs embedded into a soft and flexible silicone mask, using their trademark pillow technology, which diffuses the light to maximize skin coverage. It's also won multiple awards and performed the best in independent testing. The Current Body LED Mask uses clinically proven wavelengths to reach up to 4 millimeters of skin tissue, stimulating the cells from within using 2 wavelengths. Red light to accelerate collagen production, calm redness, and even out skin tone, and near-infrared light to boost blood circulation, bringing oxygen to the cells, triggering the body's natural healing process. It's super easy to incorporate the LED mask into your skincare routine, as it only takes 10 minutes use 3 to 5 times a week, which is recommended for optimal results. It doesn't have to be plugged in, so you can use it whenever works best for you. I like to use it when I'm meditating. So if you've been curious about the benefits of LED light therapy and would like to shop the Current Body LED mask, head over to currentbody.com or click the link in the show notes and use code CURLMAVEN for 15% off all Current Body skin devices, including the LED mask. Thank you so much to Current Body for sponsoring this episode. How would other people describe or define you? Do you think the first thing is that you're a Muslim woman, or do you think that they describe or define you as something else first?
So after being visibly, well, yeah, because I don't think I'm visibly Muslim. I think I've always gotten away with being I'm kind of racially ambiguous sometimes, unless they're Moroccan and they know me. Like they spot me like, well, we know you. But other than that, I feel like amongst society, I've always unfortunately had the privilege of sometimes not sticking out or not looking too different. And I say that because the few times that I have worn a hijab out publicly on the way to and from the mosque, I have experienced different looks, different. And I'm like, whoa, like, whoa, whoa. Like, shout out to my Muslim sisters, because you guys are absolutely warriors. And every time something happens, whether it's in this country or outside this country, tensions always go up. And I think, oh my God, it's so scary. It's so scary. So I kind of, yeah, I feel like it's an unfortunate one because it's kind of like I get to enjoy hiding. But since joining the agency and being like, hello, everyone, like, this is what I am. Like, people didn't really know who I was unless I mentioned Ramadan Mubarak or Eid Mubarak, or I'm in Morocco with my family. Generally, people didn't really pick up on it. So it was the first time that I was very much loud and proud.
Was it vulnerable, or was it empowering, or was it a mix of the two or something else?
It's definitely a mix. It's definitely empowering because I feel like I want my daughter and my former students to be able to look and be like, look at Miss, or look at Mom. And she's, you know, very much unapologetically who she is. And that is who I am. Like, I'm like, yeah, what about it? But at the same time, it's like, I didn't want to also put myself in a box, in a labeled box. I kind of loved this kind of generic, like, you don't know who I am unless I tell you. And it's kind of on a need to know basis. And I think the more you tell people about who you are, the more they box you in. And I've actually learned that in this industry, I have been boxed in a little bit.
Welcome to the entire theme of this podcast. It's for that exact thing. It's like, what are you being defined by, and how are you absolutely refusing? And like, no, I'm undefined by that. And this is how I haven't let it affect my life experience or my choices or my career or my relationships or any of that. So yeah, I can totally see how it would be a mixture of a lot of emotions. So what are you doing now?
So I left talent management because I wanted to focus on being a content creator full time. And I felt that being a talent manager, I slowly was morphing back into teacher mode. And it was that cycle again coming back. And I just think that's the nature of who I am, clearly, because I love teaching, because it gave me that opportunity. I did realize, I was like, I'm actually really good at like having the strategies and the ideas behind social media. So I've always had a backup plan my whole life, you know, on a good day or a bad day, the bills are paid.
Is there a reason why?
Security. I don't know if it's an ADHD thing, but it's definitely something that I've always been like, I can't, I refuse to worry about money. Like, I just, I don't need to be rich. I just need my bills paid. And then I can focus on something else. And I think the minute I'm like, oh, I don't know where my money's coming from, that stirs two emotions in me, either panic, worry, and stress, or pushes me to kind of go the other way and like, okay, I don't have anything else. Let's go. I need to stop being so comfortable. And I think I will never step out of this comfort and actually achieve what my peers are achieving. So I had to give up every side income and I needed to remove everything so that I can go full throttle. And it's funny because you hear a lot of like these strategists online that's like, have 7 streams of income. Girl, no, I'm trying to just do one. Mm-hmm. Just want one good one. So I did that in October. I left my job officially at the end of September. I did that in October and then found out burnout. Part two.
Yeah, part two. Yeah. I saw you call it B on one of your posts and I was like, that is a cute way of putting it. But to me, that would be like, that's the denial of how serious this is. And it's like, I need to put a comedic, lighthearted spin on this crippling burnout in order to like get through the day.
So I never live post anything negative that's happening because I've seen how addictive it can be. Not for myself, but I've seen how addictive it can be for others. Once you start getting that attention and once you start, and unfortunately, and you know this, negative attracts negative and negative spreads faster. So when I decide to share things, it's months after it's happened.
I'm the same. I need to be the other side of it so that also I'm not, people aren't feeding off of my negativity and kind of fueling it. But also I need to get the other side of it. So one, I can process it, but also when I am telling you about it, I've already got positives from it that I can share and not necessarily spin it and do a disservice to how hard or negative it was. But I am very much, if I'm not talking, it's because I'm going through something and I'm not going to tell you about it at the time. I'll tell you about it when I'm the other side. And now I'm feeling better about it, or I can see some kind of positive thing that came from it. And I know you mentioned somewhere in between all of that, a recent diagnosis of ADHD. Where did that come? At what time did that come? And has it played a factor in any of the decisions that you've made more recently since the diagnosis?
My first kind of glimpse of it was through Caroline Hirón.
So I'll stop you there because I just wanted to add, I've always spotted that my son had what I considered autism. And then when we got into the diagnosis proper, they were like, I think ADHD is on the table as well. And then after a 2.5-hour interview about my son with autism, they closed the book. And the first thing they said to me was, do you think that maybe you have autism as well? And I was like, well, actually, you know, the more we're getting into this, the more I'm like, if I was filling this form out for myself, I think I'd definitely be up there. But yeah, Caroline Hirón's was the same for me. And I think me and you both look at Caroline Hirón's in a very similar way. You obviously get to spend much more time with her. I've only seen her on a couple of occasions, but that was huge. And I don't think it was huge for only us. I think it was huge for a huge swathe of women that, you know, were already all up in her stuff and could already identify and resonate with things that she was doing and saying. So that's so strange because it's so bizarre that it both came from the same person.
Well, congratulations.
Yeah.
It's quite the thing. Now, looking at ADHD symptoms pre-motherhood, it was like, oh yeah, I'm forgetful and yeah, I'm this, but I'm still functional. All of the reasons why women are misdiagnosed and everything is because we're just like, get on with it.
Mm-hmm.
Once I had the baby,
yeah,
this lovely little thing called baby brain never left. But Nathima, the kid is 2. I was like, oh yeah, no, I don't think it's baby brain anymore. And I was like, is this the ADHD? And I think also my husband picked up on it.
I was going to say, did Carlos kind of like, hey babe?
Yeah, but he threw it in an argument and it was the wrong time to do it.
Oh, that's the wrong time. That's the wrong time, babe.
His timing. Yeah, it was like, babe, you could have done it differently, but no, it had to be in an argument, didn't it? And then I was like, yeah. And for that reason, I stubbornly did not tell him about my assessment. I didn't tell him until I got diagnosed. Because it was just one of those, like, you're not going to be right about this. But I had decided, I think I need to talk to someone. And this was September 2022. I'm still on the waiting list in February 24 for the NHS. I got an update letter to say there's going to be another 20-month wait. So I was like, take your time, guys. I've already been diagnosed and gone through to the other side. So I saved up a little bit over a couple of months. And then I was like, okay, I'm going to have a conversation. So I didn't tell anyone. I went through the entire process by myself, got my diagnosis in November of 22. And oh my God. Yeah. It was such a like validating phone call. I knew to expect that they were going to ask about my childhood and my school, but none of the questions I thought they would ask, they asked the most random question that caught me off guard. And it was so sad because it was like I was grieving for this like kid version of myself that was misunderstood.
Same.
It was really sad.
I actually stopped looking and researching online because it was bringing, and this may sound overdramatic to people that haven't gone through this, but I felt devastated for my younger self in all the different ages and, you know, situations. And a diagnosis is so validating of like, there wasn't anything wrong with me. That wasn't my fault. Like, oh my God, I was giving myself such a hard time trying to, you know, do what I thought other people were doing. And then when you throw autism in the mix as well, then that brings a whole other level. But mm-hmm. I wasn't ready or prepared for some of the types of questions and how it would make me feel. I did have support. My partner knew that I've been going for the assessments and he had to help me do some of them, and my best friend and, you know, things like that. Although I haven't had support from family, I've had support from like my friends and my partner. So I can't imagine what it's like going through something like that on your own. Is there any way that you feel that you've been misunderstood or misjudged because any of those things?
That's that thing of like feeling heartbroken for your past self, because, you know, yes, I feel like other people have misunderstood me, but I feel like I've misunderstood myself. Like, and that's the sad thing. It's just like, because you always doubt yourself in life, right? And
yeah,
again, imposter syndrome, but that inner voice that is the one that makes you get out of bed.
Mm.
It's so sad to think that like it was all kind of self-inflicted. So I feel like it's a hard one because I am sensitive to how I'm perceived, but not because I care. I'm sensitive to how I'm perceived because I don't want to make someone feel bad in my company, or, you know, very feel that way, that kind of thing. Very polite about it.
So it's not how you feel, it's how you might make someone else feel.
Oh yeah, because I bring in back all of the lovely qualities, do not care what people think about me. I could not care less. And so I'm very much blunt with people. If I don't like something, I say it. And if I don't say it, that's because I'm choosing peace. And I'm like, you're not worth it enough to me. So a lot of people come out of being diagnosed with ADHD with this kind of paranoia of what people think and what must people think. Oh, hell no, that's not me. But my thing is, how do I make people feel? And I feel that I hold on to that. And it's like, I don't want to make someone feel this or make someone feel that. But I will overthink and like overanalyze and hold on to this one little thing that I've said to you that might make you feel a certain way.
Yeah, yeah, I'm the very same. And I've even sought people out like months later to apologize to them. And they're like, oh God, I must have forgotten that very day. Like, have you been worrying about this the whole time? I'm like, yeah, it's been 9 months and I've played this conversation several times. And I'm like, so you're good. And they're like, I was never any other way. I've been good the whole time. I'm like, oh, okay, great, cool. So I'm so intrigued to hear the answer to this next question. Just knowing all of that, who do you look up to or admire and why?
I'm a family girl and I'll always admire, I think, my mum first, because she raised the four of us on her own, because my dad worked abroad. So my dad very regularly moved from country to country, and I have a sister with special needs, and I cannot imagine. I have one child. She had four, and one of which she still cares for full time. I admire people that I know personally, and I like to be around very positive, very ambitious, very empowering women, because I think that it kind of, the environment that you're in kind of supports you in your own journey.
So then in terms of now, what you're doing now, how are you going to define success so that then you'll know I'm doing the thing, I've achieved it, or I'm on the way, or yes, this is like, what is your definition of success?
When I was looking into ADHD, I did not find a single person that looked like me, came from my background and grew up in my kind of similar, you know, surrounding that spoke about it. In a lot of ethnic backgrounds, it's not, mental health is not spoken about and or understood. So the reason that I've chosen to kind of be open about ADHD is just to be able to be someone that looks like me, comes from my background, believes what I believe, and talk about it. The conversation that I had with the doctor was, you've had a degree and you've this and you've done a teaching, you've done postgraduate and you've had a child. How have all these moments in your life shaped you and how did they make you feel? And that's when I realized, I was like, every single one of those moments, I'm like, meh. And I noticed it last week. Last week, I hit a milestone on TikTok, which has never been a focus, but I just know that like, if I want to be full-time, I have to hit certain numbers and certain targets. I hit 100,000 followers on TikTok. It's been a target for like the last 2-3 years. I could not care less. It was just like, I was like, really, dude? Really? After all this, I was like, oh man, like.
Is it that's good enough? Or is it because you've already moved on to the next thing? Like, yep, done that, tick, next.
I think it's a mix of those two things. Plus it's in the grand scheme of things, it's not like, it's not that important or it's not that deep. Or, you know, how do I tell my dad, or like, how do I tell people from my background that's like, oh my God, I had this many followers on TikTok. And they're like, what the hell is that? Like, because I feel like social media is still in a place where a lot of people are like, it's not real life. And I totally get that. Mm-hmm. And I also think there's a little bit of a stigma of like, if you went from being an educator to like getting paid for putting creams on her face.
What is the best or worst piece of advice you've ever received? And did you follow that advice?
Advice from single non-parenting men about how to be a mother and what's expected of me. And if there were to be any negative things that I've ever had based on who I am, it's always been as a woman or as a Muslim woman, but never as a Moroccan woman, which is quite interesting.
Is interesting. And do you feel that they're just putting all Muslim people, whether they're women or men, all in together, and they've got this preconceived notion about it, and now you're going to get to hear all about it and you better take it? Is that what it feels like?
I think the difficult conversations now come from whatever's happening in the media. It's directly because we are online. Whenever there's something that happens and you're just like, oh, please don't be Muslim. Please don't be Muslim. Please don't be Muslim. You know, it's very sad and I wish it didn't happen to anyone, but we just know it's about to be another showdown.
What advice would you give if there is a Muslim woman that is listening to this and they're like, I'm getting that heat? What advice would you give them?
So I don't know how many seconds of the day exist. And I heard this one recently and it encapsulates it perfectly. It's like, you've got, someone's taken £10 from you and you've still got 80 grand in your account. Are you going to spend the rest of the day trying to get that £10 back and waste the opportunity of the day when you still got £80,000 in your account?
I think that's an incredibly mature answer. And I'm sure.
Side note.
Yeah, yeah. Hold on. Part one. Part two is,
there's times where I'm like, do you know what? Now I've got time today. I've got nothing else on my schedule. And do you know what I do, which is kind of therapeutic, is I write the response. In a very, very well written, I think I still have my way of words. I'm like, okay, I'm not the most confident writer, but actually when it comes to clapping back, the words just flow. Yeah. I write my response and then I delete it and then I block them. I've always have to remember that it's just a comment. It's just a comment. It's not worth going into like letting it spiral out of control. So type the response, delete it, block, move on.
What is one question that you wish I had asked you and how would you have answered?
I think this one is for the Muslim women who are not encouraged to go out and be, alpha is not the word, but kind of like the providers. I think there's a big, 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 big stigma around the woman being the provider or providing more. I'm okay with that. And so are all the women in my family. So the question could have been, how do you feel, how is the dynamic in your household being potentially the person that earns more in a society where it's expected that the husband not only earns more, but fully provides? And my answer is, I don't belong to a man. I don't belong to my husband. I don't belong to anyone. I live for me. And the example that I want to set to my daughter is not to, and this is not knocking anyone that lives that lifestyle of fully provided by their husband. Sometimes I swear to God, I wake up and I'm like, I wish that was me. Ultimately, the type of person that I am a provider. I've always felt and loved and wanted to be the person to give things to people, whether it's my parents, my sisters, my kids. Why not also my partner? I actually feel really proud of myself as a working Muslim mother that I can provide for myself, depend on myself, and be able to provide for my family and support my family. And I think there's nothing wrong with that. So yes, there's, you know, the arguments that people are like, you know, Islamically, your husband needs to provide for you. That's absolutely fine if that's the road that you want to go down. I am so fiercely independent and I get that from my mom. So for me, that's kind of, that's where I count my achievements is, can I support myself and others? And I'm totally okay with that. And I think that stigma needs to disappear a little bit.
Would you like more Muslim women to view their achievements in that same light or to even dare to kind of accept that that could be something for them?
I would love for this idea of Muslim women not being able to provide and work. I see it a lot in my community. It's like once a woman gets married and then has kids, some of them just kind of go into quiet mode. And it's absolutely fine for anyone that chooses that. But I'm talking towards the women who it's not their choice. My thing is, you do what you want, but let it be normalized for those that choose to be up there and out there and working and, you know, potentially the breadwinners. It's okay.
Yeah.
Ultimately, if that's what keeps your family happy, if, you know, if your partner's happy with that. And I actually think a lot more men are.
I think it takes a certain type of man to be okay with that and to not be threatened by an independent, empowered woman. And for me, I'm with you because I want to be, not because I have to be or I need to be. And so therefore, you should take that as a compliment, because if I didn't want to be here, I would not, because I am self-sufficient and I am independent and I am, you know, an empowered woman. Just before you go, what are you undefined by?
What am I undefined by? Do you know what? I'm just me, GC, living my best life. In the wise words of Gemma Collins, I'm just trying to do me, babes.
She's on my list of guests. I absolutely want to have her on because I think she would be amazing.
I love her. You know, there are many adversities that people face and there are many things that people can be defined with because of how they physically look. And that's kind of out of your control because people will have preconceived notions about you. And then there's the people that potentially I fall under where it's like, I could hide. I could kind of be a bit invisible if I wanted to. And that's a privilege, which those people don't have. But ultimately, we are all here for ourselves. And as much as society dictates how you should and shouldn't live and how you should be, you're a Muslim woman, so you can't be this. And you don't wear a hijab, so you're not a proper good Muslim woman. All of that is background noise because if you allow it, if you entertain it and you allow it to fester, oh, then that becomes your identity. But actually...
So you're undefined by being a Muslim woman?
Yeah, in the weirdest way possible, I'm undefined by every single...
It's part of you, but it doesn't define who you are.
I only say that because the minute you open the door and allow people to define you, you're never going to be defined as who you actually are. If you let other people do the defining for you, then... you're never good enough. You're not good enough as a Moroccan because you didn't marry a Moroccan. Not good enough as a Muslim because you don't wear a hijab. You're not good enough as a Brit because you're not actually from here. You weren't born in the UK. It's up to you to define yourself, and anyone else's perception and notion and opinion is a reflection of them, and it's them projecting. And I think that's what makes people shy away from being proud of who they are because of other people. Always, always other people. So actually... If you take control and wipe that slate and be like, all right, cool. I wear a hijab and what? You're not going to box me and I don't need to be at home looking after the kids. I can be on a big campaign on Leicester Square. And then what? Wearing my hijab and then what? And in the way that I want to wear it. There we go. So yeah, hopefully that makes any sense.
Yeah. It does. It does. So if anybody wanted to find out more about you or follow you or work with you, where do they find you? How do they get in touch?
At Buseema on TikTok and Instagram. So it's BEAUSSIMA. I'm always welcoming people who come from very similar backgrounds, or even like former teachers that are like, I want to leave teaching. What do I do? What transferable skills do I have? I have a lot of people ask about mixed marriages, mixed cultures. So I'm always here. And I'd like to think I have a well-rounded, open-minded view of life.
I think you do.
This has been so much fun. It's like a bit of a therapy session.
Oh, wow. There you go. Sometimes I feel like it's as much of a therapy for me, though. I'm like out here like spilling my guts and my soul on the mic. Oh, isn't she amazing? I just love her. I think there's a lot that all women can take from the advice she gave to Muslim women about society expectations of what a woman should be or do, and the stigma attached to being a working wife and mother that potentially earns more than the husband or the partner. Let me know what you think or what resonated for you. You can follow Nasima at Bosima on Instagram and TikTok. That's BEAUSSIMA. I'll leave her links in the show notes. So that's it. That's my first guest episode. I really hope you enjoyed our conversation. If you'd like to hear more, here's a clip of what's coming up in the next episode, Nasima Untamed, which will be out on Thursday or the next episode in your feed. So why did the name change? Or was it like, oh no, the Berber is just, that's a Western thing that you called us, but we've always been the other
one. Yeah, because it comes from barbaric. And that's basically it. So it's kind of like decolonizing that name and going back to what we call ourselves, which is Emezia. This debate and argument is bigger online than it is in society. And it all kicked off again in the World Cup, and it always kicks off where this like the identity of Moroccans, like, well, if you claim Arab, then you're kind of going with the colonizers. And in reality, when you go to Morocco, absolutely nobody cares. Morocco is Moroccan.
Thank you so much for listening. Please hit the follow button and give it a 5-star rating, as it will really help get this independent podcast off the ground and make it a success, so I can bring you more incredible conversations with guests just like this one. You can find me on Instagram at Curl Maven, or this podcast at Undefined By, or you can send me an email at hello@undefinedby.com with any questions, suggestions, or guest requests. And remember, you can get 15% off all Current Body skin devices at currentbody.com using code CURLMAVEN. I'll leave the link and all the details in the show notes. Thank you for listening, and I'll chat to you in the next episode, out this Thursday. Bye.